Accession number 11627, reel 1.
Sir Stephen Spender, reel 1. Could I ask you, first of all, about an act which some people regard as having precipitated the Second World War, the Soviet-German Pact of August 1939. And can you tell me what you remember about receiving the news of it and its effect on you?
Yes, well, I imagined or supposed that it would be much more active than it was. I mean, the effect it had on me was to imagine England being bombed by the combined Russian and German air forces. I thought it meant, in effect, a declaration of war together with Germany on the democracies. That was my first immediate reaction. I mean, sort of nightmare reaction when I read that, saw headlines about it.
Did it come as a complete surprise to you?
Yes, it did. Yes, I realized that the attempts of the English government to negotiate with the Soviets was going very badly. But then I think Stalin made his speech about that he was not going to pull chestnuts out of the fire for the democracies. And so I imagined that the Soviet Union would sit the war out, which in fact, as a matter of fact, they did try to do.
Did you regard it as a reasonable act by the Soviet government or one of perfidy?
I regard it as one of perfidy. I didn't, and because after all, fascism and the Nazis were as bad as people said, and during the Spanish Civil War, my whole generation, I suppose, like-thinking people, had regarded Russia as the outstandingly anti-fascist power, which the only government, as a matter of fact, which sent troops to support the Spanish, or sent armaments anyhow to support the Spanish Republic, and so on. So that I thought that the one thing you could say about the communists, I mean, I was against the communists at that time because I thought that the communists took over power from the Republic in Spain, or gradually more and more dominated the Republic in Spain. But the one thing one did feel about them is that they were anti-fascist and anti-Nazi.
What did you feel about the state of our own country when Chamberlain felt he had to make the declaration of war on the 3rd of September?
Well, I thought this was quite right. I mean, I didn't. The way in which Chamberlain did it wasn't very inspiring. I mean, that he felt he personally had been betrayed, let down by Hitler, and so on. And I think that what one felt was that anti-fascism had, as I'd known it, which was a highly individualist kind of thing, of individuals, for instance, going and fighting in Spain, that anti-fascism had become dissolved into a war which was of industrial powers against one another. But I mean, in that war, I was on the side of the democracies. There was no longer quite the feeling of the 1930s in the war. And in fact, people who had been anti-fascists during the Spanish Civil War, for example, were treated by Chamberlain's government and by, I think, all succeeding governments with great suspicion by the British. I remember the Tom Wintringham I'm in various cases in which it was suggested, I think, by perhaps Picture Post and various organs like that, that we should use the talents of people like Tom Wintringham, who had experience of fighting in the Spanish Civil War, because the kind of fighting that might occur if England was invaded, and they were treated very badly by the British Army. And then later in America, there was a phrase called premature antifascist. To be a premature antifascist was considered really being a communist.
What effects did the outbreak of war have on your own position as an artist? Did you feel that it affected your creativity at first?
No, it didn't. It really didn't change things very much. I mean, except because I immediately... I was very involved with friends of mine, like Cyril Connolly with Horizon. In fact, I mean, the war for me at the beginning meant that I was co-editing Horizon with Cyril Connolly. And so so really, I think that we thought that there was a kind of double involvement. First, to try to keep literature and the arts free of politics, but secondly, nevertheless, to be on the side of the democracy against fascism. I think that's what Horizon really did stand for.
One thing that you wrote somewhere which very much struck me about the war and Horizon was that I think that you said that certain Battle of Britain pilots came into the offices of Horizon and said that what they felt they were fighting for was what Horizon stood for.
Well, that's so. I think that Horizon and also, I suppose, John Layman's magazine New Writing were a real inspiration, as a matter of fact, to... I think there was a strong desire among quite a lot of young people. I mean, I couldn't put numbers to them, but they'd include the readers, the considerable readership of Horizon and the still greater readership of New Writing, that they wanted to be fighting not just for a political cause, but also for some kind of cultural freedom, really, for the arts, really. In the cause of individuals, I think.
Did you actually meet this Battle of Britain pilot who came in and said
this? Yes, well, I knew, Michael Jones, Timothy Corsellis. I'm not sure. Michael Jones, I think, was killed in an accident while he was still training. Timothy Corsellis was a transatlantic pilot. William J. Sepro, who was also killed, was a Canadian. There were people who did come into the office of Horizon and say this.
Late in 1939, Auden and Isherwood went to the USA. What was your reaction to their going there?
Well, I got into great trouble for criticising them. But it's always... I think it wasn't that I criticised them for going so much as that one missed them and one felt that they would have been very important. Also, you see, in fact, some of these pilots I was mentioning, or one of them anyhow, Michael Jones, was a pupil of Auden. And Auden was always saying at the preparatory school that he taught at, that's the task of our generation, was to fight, to resist fascism, or to fight fascism, because it threatened non-politics, I mean non-political right, and the basic freedom to write work which was non-political, as well as threatening the people who politically opposed it. And I think some of these boys felt very disconcerted when their much-admired hero went off to America in 1938. But anyhow, I did write, I think, only one or two things which are rather critical of this. It always seemed then causing, of course, I suffered much more from it than they did, because, you know, it was against all the sort of attitude of people like E.M. Forster and so on. But it always seemed rather funny to me that you could criticise their works, but that you couldn't criticise, it was regarded as betrayal to criticise their actions, which actually were very much bound up with their works. And also, when one further felt that especially Ordengoing was a tremendous loss, I think, if you consider the kind of poetry that he would have written if he'd remained in England. And so although I feel rather ashamed of myself, you know, for having criticised or attacked their going to America, on the other hand, I sort of pinch myself and say, well, after all, you can criticise people, can't you? You can criticise the writings and the behaviour of artists as it affects their writing. There seemed something very characteristically, and perhaps in a good way, sort of English about this feeling that you must never criticise a person for not fighting for his country. It all come. Or not remaining in his country, not necessarily fighting for it. And it goes back to E.M. Forster writing that if he had to choose between betraying his friend or betraying his country, he hoped he'd betray his country, not his friend. But it depends who your friend was. I mean, supposing your friend was Goering, would you feel like that? But I feel very unsure about that. I mean, I mean, on the whole, I suppose it was better not to have, at that point, to have criticised them.
How did they react to the criticism?
Rather badly, I think. No, I mean, not. I mean, in a perfectly gentlemanly way. I mean. They never broke off their friendship with me or anything like that.
In the summer of 1940, people often say nowadays that Britain and the Empire stood alone and speak with a certain amount of pride about that. Was there any sense of that feeling then with you and your friends?
Yes, but reading it now, reading history now, we really knew very little about the situation. I mean, I always assumed that England would win the war, but I didn't really know the facts of the case. Also, I was really very decidedly anti-fascist. I mean, anti-fascism is really one of the strongest feelings that I've had in my life, and I don't think I would, in any circumstances, have gone back on that. I made a kind of pact with Leonard Woolf. I mean, not terribly seriously, but because it was impossible to envisage the situation that we'd commit suicide if England was invaded. I don't know about Leonard. I think Lenin and I were both on Hitler's black list, you see, which you would know about from the Imperial War Museum. I mean, there my commitment was really absolute. Later, I mean, reading now books about that period of the war, one realizes that England, in effect, had really lost the war in 1940 if it hadn't been saved by sort of various miracles, such as Hitler deciding to attack Russia and so on. But I never felt this because I really didn't know. I mean, I didn't know the facts weren't published. Friends of mine, like my friend William Plumer, who were in the Admiralty, I could see they were very strained. But they, of course, couldn't tell anything about the facts that they knew. Harold Nicholson, I must say, Harold Nicholson must have known a great deal, was extremely good about it. I mean, he said, I do remember asking Harold Nicholson in 1940 whether he thought that it was whether we should make peace or could make peace or what would happen if we did make peace. And he said, well, of course we could, and it all seemed lovely for 6 months or a year or some period. And then we'd disagree. The Nazis would decide to take, I don't know, Canada or something, and we would object. The next thing we'd see was the German fleet sailing down the Thames. And I'm sure that was the case. So therefore, I mean, someone wrote an article, Mr. Coleman, wasn't it, I think, in the Independent, I think it was, saying that reviewing all the latest material, we ought to have made peace. Well, it's absolute, I mean, I consider that point of view absolute nonsense. Unless you accept the fact that that England would have been like occupied France or like Germany itself. I mean, we'd have been in any the opposition would all have been in concentration camps.
From what you said earlier, it seems as though you had assumed that once the German army got across, that Britain would be finished, that our resistance would have crumbled.
Oh, no, I didn't think. Did I say anything to that? No, I didn't mean that at all. Well, I don't know what had happened if the German army had got across. I really don't know.
But was your assumption that they wouldn't be able to make it across the Channel?
I didn't know at all. No, I thought they might. I remember my uncle Sir George Schuster telling me that they would, and there'd be an airborne, and all these parachutists would arrive, and so on. It all seemed perfectly feasible that they should.
What effect, if any, did Churchill's speeches of that summer have on you?
Oh, very inspiring. I mean, I really did think that... Churchill may have made any number of mistakes, but I think that England was, in a way, held together by a kind of patriotic poetry and by language, really, and above all, by Churchill. I mean, Churchill was a kind of throwback, in a way, of a kind that at that moment in our history we needed very much, and I think that his speeches were magnificent and that they expressed what people realized the moment they had been expressed was what they most deeply felt, and that England was very united in that sense. I think that England during the war was very enjoyable. It was a kind of socialism doesn't seem very successful in producing that kind of society, but occasionally you understand what the best kind of socialism would be like, and it's usually, and I mean, for instance, one felt it in Spain during the Spanish Civil War in Barcelona places. Perhaps it was illusory there because it was achieved by putting all the right-wing people in the Republic into prison or frightening them a great deal. But in England during the war, it was really spontaneous. There was a feeling that everyone was sharing with everyone else. People could talk to one another. And that was... One never had in the services, well, I never had, I'm sure I never had it in any of the services, certainly I didn't in the fire service, any feeling except that all of us in the... at our fire stations were completely equal with everyone else, and as far as the war was concerned, I think that's what everyone felt, and that was the best side of the war.
I think you said somewhere about tiredness producing this kind of easiness in relations between the different sections of society.
Well, yes, I think possibly tiredness did enter into it. Everyone was a bit tired, and therefore for that reason relaxed.
You also said somewhere about England being an island of civilization. Is that what you meant by that, or were you talking about the cultural life of London?
Well, I think... I was thinking, really, in a way, of the rhetoric, which was very civilised, begins with Churchill. It was also a period, a great revival of Shakespeare, as a matter of fact. I mean, there were wonderful Shakespearean performances during the Blitz. There was a kind of revival of the arts, really, in the theatre. And also in, say, the concerts that were given at the National Gallery. And there wasn't a feeling that this was just what a small, which statistically perhaps it was, a very small group of people. It was something which everyone accepted and admired. And, I mean, artists were sort of brave people. I mean, they were artists. Say in the forces and the fire service, the pianists who played at the National Gallery concerts went on playing when bombs were being dropped and things like that. So there was a kind of shared sense of values, I think.
Did you go to those concerts yourself?
Yes, I did. Yes, whenever I could.
You also talked about in the fire service that you had political discussions or discussions about the future of the country. Can you tell me how they were organised and what part you played in them?
Well, I think that what happened was that my war was rather funny as regards the fire service, because I joined the fire service in the middle of the Blitz, and then I had to have 6 weeks or 2 months training up. And the moment I'd finished training, the Blitz stopped. I mean, like that, absolutely dead. And there were very few raids for 3 years, really. Then, all the time I was trying to get into the Foreign Office, well, the Foreign Office German department especially wanted me to be in. But in a way one experiences a bit what it's like living in a totalitarian society, because I was simply blocked by the Ministry of Labour. And I found the reason, later on I found, because I'd got to know someone who was a clerk in the military, in the Ministry of Labour. And so I said, now do something, just look up my file. And he looked up my file, my asking to belong to the... To go over to the German part of the Foreign Office, my application, and I think their application too, for me to do that. And written across it was, I see no reason why this man should be transferred. Someone called Freer, F-R-E-R-E, a publisher, who had written this, and this had completely blocked my being transferred, until I suddenly remembered that I shouldn't have been in the fire service anyway on grounds of health. And so then I asked for medical examination. And when I had a medical examination, instead of difficulties, I was immediately thrown out. Within 24 hours, I was thrown out of the fire service. So, in a way, that's a sort of little experience of the totalitarianism which is peculiar to war, isn't it, really?
Yes. What do you think is the explanation for this Freer having acted in this way?
Just like getting a bad review or something, like someone who thinks, you know, this young writer's absolutely, I don't like what he writes, I don't see why he should, he's better being a fireman than pretending to be able to write poetry or something, I don't know, the kind of feelings, same feelings as give you a bad review. G.S. Freer, I think.
What should have given you the idea to apply for the fire service?
Because friends of mine, Henry Green and Henry York, Henry Green, the writer, and William Sampson, they were in the fire service, and also the painter Victor Passmore, and they all asked me to join. They said the fire service was a very good thing. And it wasn't, I'm not a pacifist, but I didn't really want to be involved in killing people. And I'm sufficiently pacifist for that, really. And I suppose I didn't want to be killed either. I suppose I wanted to. I mean, the war did offer honourable ways of being able to carry on with the work which you believed was your vocation, and not being sort of cowardly, really.
Was it easy to get into the fire service?
Very.
What exactly did you have to do?
I just go to a fire station and say you wanted to join.
And then you became an auxiliary fireman?
Then I became an auxiliary fireman, yes.
And that at that time it was the London Fire Service rather than the National Fire Service?
I think at the first it was the London Fire Service, then it changed, I've forgotten when, to the National Fire Service.